and to our Sundance crew, Yodivio Barrios, Mike Scholes, Richard Lavelle, Jim Lemon, Dennis Moynihan, Brenda Murad, and our thoughts are with Mike Burke and the funeral of his mother today. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Get worked up to a fever pitch. A mix of soul, jazz, hip-hop, folk, and everything in between. 60 delicious minutes of music that starts slow and ends in a frenzy. It's electric. It's euphoric. It's a fever pitch. Tuesdays at 2 p.m. with Alex Remington on CFRU 93.3 FM.
Strap yourself in. It's time for another edition of Terra Informa. On this week's show, Terra Informa correspondents David Katchen and Miles Curry take a close look at our new federal environment minister, Mr. Peter Kent. So if you're interested in who's calling the shots on the environment in Ottawa these days, be sure to stick around. We also have an interview with Tom Radford, a filmmaker whose most recent work, Tipping Point, The Age of the Oil Sands, will be airing this week on David Suzuki's The Nature of Things. But first up, we have a special guest for the news this week. Rebecca Rooney and her mother, Brenda Rooney, will give us the rundown of this week's news. Over to you, Rebecca.
Thanks, Andy. We'll start things off in Manitoba this week, where scientists and citizens groups are calling for a moratorium on cottage development along the shores of Lake Winnipeg and other Manitoban lakes. They want shoreline construction to cease until the provincial government develops a policy to protect shorelines and watersheds that is founded on scientific principles. Currently, shoreline reserve lands are managed by local municipalities, but Vicky Burns, the coordinator of the Lake Winnipeg Watershed Initiative, says it is time that the province takes over that responsibility. In an interview with the Winnipeg Free Press, she said, quote, "It really should be considered publicly owned, and nobody should be able to alter it. I know the rural municipalities want to see development because it keeps their tax base up, but we need to take a hard look at it and not do developments simply to raise our tax bases because there will be greater costs in the future," end quote. Unregulated development on lakeshores is destroying the surrounding marshlands that act to naturally filter out excess nutrients and sediment before runoff enters a lake. Without the presence of protective marshes, lakes can become cloudy with sediment or choked by toxic algae blooms.
The provincial government in New Brunswick has arranged to hold a public forum on shale gas development in the town of Sussex on January 29th. Already, Texas-based Apache and Halifax-based Corridor Resources are exploring the prospects of shale gas mining near the town. If the two companies find sufficient natural gas, they may team up to drill as many as 480 new wells in the area. Shale gas is accessed by a controversial process known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. During fracking, companies pump a mixture of water, sand, and chemicals into the ground that fracture the shale layer, letting them extract natural gas from areas that would otherwise remain trapped in the shale rock. Individuals and property owners concerned about exploration, environmental safeguards, landowner rights, economic benefits, and employment will be able to question government and industry officials during the meeting. According to David Kuhn of New Brunswick's Conservation Council, people are right to have concerns.
Based on what's happened already across the United States in some number of states is contamination of well water, reduction in supply of water from water withdrawals, Air quality problems when you start to get quite a lot of drilling activity in a concentrated area. The industrialization of the local community where the drilling is intense.
The Conservation Council is concerned that provincial regulations may not be stringent enough to protect New Brunswick's water resources. But Natural Resources Minister Bruce Northrop promises that fracking will only proceed if it can be done safely.
We're very concerned about the water source for sure. As we all know, what happened in the Penobscot area back in 2004, where 55 families lost their water, and it really hit home when I got elected in 2006 to see the frustration and the anger on the faces of the people around the Penobscot area, and I don't want to see that again.
Over in British Columbia, concerns were raised last week when a cargo ship contaminated with spilt uranium concentrate had to dock in the port of Vancouver to replenish fuel and supplies. The ship was carrying uranium from the Saskatchewan mining company Cameco to China when it hit rough seas just north of Hawaii earlier in January. In the course of the storm, two barrels of the radioactive cargo were damaged and spilled their contents into the ship's hold. The ship, the MCP Altona, was therefore forced to return to its port of origin, Vancouver, to await plans for remediation. On January 20th, the MCP Altona had to dock in the port of Vancouver in order to replenish its fuel and other supplies. Although Vancouver residents have expressed concerns, the company claims there is no need to be alarmed. Rob Garrity, a representative of Cameco, says,
"Ultimately, we look at this as a very routine procedure. People are safe. The environment is safe."
According to a media advisory released by Cameco, the company is currently working with the BC government to finalize plans for a full remediation of the ship's hold. Meanwhile, the uranium remains confined in the ship's hold, and the hold will remain sealed and locked until remediation activities commence.
And to round things out, we have a good news story from Ontario, where the Southern Ontario Bald Eagle Monitoring Project reports that bald eagle numbers are on the rise. In 1980, there were zero successful breeding pairs in Ontario, but since then, a gradual decline in environmental contaminants, especially the organic pesticide DDT, has coincided with a gradual improvement in bald eagle numbers. The recovery has been ongoing for over a decade, and in August 2009, the bald eagle's status was reduced from endangered to species of special concern in Ontario. Since 2004, Bird Studies Canada's Southern Ontario Bald Eagle Monitoring Program has been tracking the movements of juvenile eagles in the area using state-of-the-art satellite tracking. A prior investigation showed that despite the population recovery, bald eagles in the region still had shorter lifespans than elsewhere on the continent, and this was attributed to the accumulation of toxic metals in their bodies. The goal of the Eagle Tracking Project is to monitor the movements of juvenile birds to determine where they are picking up those toxic chemicals. Interested listeners can follow the movements and habits of the project's eagles at the Eagle Tracker website, a link to which is posted on ours at terrainforma.ca.
Well, that brings this week's Rapid Fire News Attacks segment to a close. Back to you, Andy.
Thanks, Rebecca. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Terra Informa, providing you with the environmental news from coast to coast to coast. Whether you're crossing the Arctic tundra, fishing off the coasts of the Maritimes, or slogging your way through fields of wheat, we'll be there letting you know what's going on in your environment. There's a new boss at Environment Canada. Stephen Harper announced that Peter Kent, Conservative MP from Toronto, would be Canada's new Environment Minister earlier this month. So just who is Peter Kent, and is he up to the task? To find out, Terra Informa's David Kachin and Miles Curry spoke to a few people he'll need to work with to get their take on the new minister and what challenges he's going to face.
Being Environment Minister in the Harper government is no picnic. The numbers bear this out. 5 ministers in 5 years, with the latest stepping up to the plate just this month. The new minister, Peter Kent, hailing from Toronto, has so far stuck closely to the tone set by his boss, Stephen Harper, and his predecessors in the Environment Ministry. Terra Informa made three requests for interviews with Minister Kent without success. We were told that the minister is not doing interviews this week as he wants to focus on his policy briefings. Apparently, an interview may be a possibility later down the track, and if that does go ahead, we'll be pleased to bring it to you. So whilst we can't bring you Peter Kent in person, today on Terra Informa, we're going to give you some background on the new minister and what he's likely to deliver or otherwise in this important portfolio. To help us, we spoke with a few people he's going to need to work with. One, a politician from across the aisles, and another, a leader of a major environmental organisation. But we'll come to them later. Firstly, some background. Peter Kent entered Parliament in 2008 after running unsuccessfully in 2006. Prior to his promotion to the environmental portfolio, Peter Kent was Minister of State for Foreign Affairs for the Americas. The bulk of his career, however, has been spent in media. He worked as a foreign correspondent in Vietnam during the war and later in Johannesburg as an African correspondent. He hosted CBC's The National, The Journal, and later anchored Global News Channel's First National.
The National with Peter Kent.
Good evening. The Gallup poll brings good news for the Conservatives.
We asked NDP environment critic Linda Duncan what she thought of his resume.
Or looking back on your experience in Parliament, why do you think Peter Kent was named the new environment minister?
I have no idea. How can I explain the workings of the Prime Minister's mind? Sad to say, the big priority on dealing with significant environmental issues seems to be simply communicating rather than addressing the issues. And Peter Kent does have a communications background, so perhaps that. Maybe they're finally recognizing that we have some significant environmental, international environmental issues to address, including climate change, and because he did hold the international portfolio, that he might be able to handle that well, but who am I to say? I think it's unfortunate that, as far as I'm aware, he doesn't have any environmental background.
There is the problem of a ministry in constant flux, 5 ministers in 5 years. Linda Duncan.
Since Mr. Harper's government was established, we've gone through an awful lot of environment ministers, and we're dealing with a lot of critical issues with a critical timeline. The final agreement on the reductions for each country, including Canada, on climate change should be reached within a couple of months because the final agreement is in the end of this year in South Africa. So there are other issues, for example, the long-promised action on cleaning up the oil sands. Just the beginning of them, there's a whole issue of what's happening with water resources in Canada, and then there's the melting of the Arctic and what the environmental implications are of offshore oil development and so forth. So we need a minister that can just step up to the plate and boom, move these agendas forward. By having a revolving door, it takes a long time for the minister to be briefed, caught up to what's going on.
But it's not just politicians Peter Kent will have to work with. The national environmental organisations also want his attention. We spoke with Eric Hebert, Executive Director of CPAWS.
Is he the right person for the job?
Well, certainly Mr. Kent has tremendous amount of international experience. He understands the Canadian landscape quite well, having been a broadcaster for so many years, and also spent quite a bit of time up north back in the 70s, following around, learning what communities were saying.
Okay, so as the executive director of a major environmental organization, you don't feel frustrated at having to rebuild connections with a new minister?
Well, that is always frustrating, of course, because you do start to build an understanding of what the minister wants to achieve, and you start to build a relationship about, expressing what it is that that our organization wants to achieve, and it's difficult at times to have that kind of turnover.
Peter Kent did nothing to reassure Canada's environmental community on day two of his new job, when he reaffirmed his government's commitment to not curtail greenhouse emissions from the oil sands. In fact, the new minister went into bat for the controversial industry.
We need to reassure the American administration and the American people that Canadian oil is ethical in every sense of the word.
One thing I'd like to lead on is the comment he made about ethical oil. I mean, is that something we can expect more, someone who's more worried about how it's viewed rather than what is actually happening?
Well, I can't answer that. I mean, as the environment critic and as somebody for 40 years who have tried to work hard for Canada to address some of these major issues, I am hoping not. But the first actions are not very reassuring.
Despite his defence of the sands, however, one of the first issues he will have to deal with is water quality in the oil sands area, after a report by the Federal Scientific Panel found monitoring to be substandard.
He did, as I recall, also say, you know, we're going to move on that report. The problem is the issues that were reviewed both by the Natural Resources Committee and by our committee and by the Royal Society and by the Alberta government and most recently by the Dowdswell Committee, a group of senior scientists, talk about much more than just we need to monitor better. Very clearly, we need to be regulating a lot of substances that aren't really regulated, and we need to be seriously addressing and studying the concerns raised by First Nations. It's a lot more than monitoring.
Across the country, you're listening to Terra Informa, and today we're talking about the new Environment Minister, Peter Kent. On climate policy, Peter Kent has a difficult balancing act. The Harper government is committed to a reduction in greenhouse emissions of 20% below 2006 levels by 2020. To put this in perspective, this is a 2% increase over 1990 levels, a much feebler goal than our original Kyoto commitments. But the Harper government has stated publicly that even this modest target will depend on positive action from our American neighbours first. If that doesn't happen, Peter Kent can put his feet up. But surprisingly, that's actually not a given. Linda Duncan.
The climate change negotiations have got to be pretty front and centre for him as well. Of course, he's got the problem that the US is actually moving forward with legislation. And, well, Canada is claiming that they are in sync with the US. Here we are, caught with absolutely nothing, even a draft. Proposed legislation.
But it's not just climate and energy. Turns out, a few things have been held up at the Environment Ministry, including action plans for endangered species.
We are supposed to be coming out with a report on endangered species, and that will hopefully clearly lay out his responsibility to step up to the plate to be delivering. Right now, the Minister of Environment is breaking the law by not meeting the mandatory deadline for action plans to protect species. There are a series of court actions that citizens are having to take, so he's going to be dealing with that, he's going to be dealing with the court action against him. So that's just the beginning of some very big issues.
Yeah, it sounds like he's got a lot of work cut out ahead of him.
That's it's a big, very important portfolio.
So that's a wrap of the challenges and opportunities facing the new boss at the Environment Ministry. As we've heard, there's a lot to get done and some fiendishly difficult politics to play out, especially over climate change. We hope that his tenure lasts longer than his predecessors, or at least long enough to get something done. We'll keep trying for an interview with Peter Kent, and as soon as he agrees, we'll bring it to you. For a last word, here's NDP environment critic Linda Duncan once more.
Our role as the Canadians is to hold the minister accountable. So I'm hoping that your listeners will take that seriously and be contacting the minister and letting him know what they think the priority should be, and that we expect expedited action.
Do you care about how we treat our natural environment? Do you enjoy pursuing an issue and finding the real truths? Then we want to hear from you. Terra Informa is always looking for new volunteers from all areas of Canada. If you're interested in joining the Terra Informa team, go to our website at www.terrainforma.ca. Next up, we hear from Tom Radford, director of the new Nature of Things special on the oil sands. But first, have you ever wondered what exactly is included in the term emissions? Here's Marcus Peterson with this week's EcoBabble.
Diversity.
Automated metering infrastructure.
Natural energies.
Regulate CO2.
PM control strategies.
Natural resource exploitation.
Steady state.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Sustainable energy.
EcoBabble.
Hey guys, here's your EcoBabble for this week. Emissions. Emissions is an umbrella term that encompasses any waste discharged into the air. This could be from a smokestack or your car's tailpipe. Of course, we hear a lot about carbon emissions, the discharge of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere responsible for the majority of the human-induced greenhouse gas effect. Other important pollution emissions include sulfur oxides, responsible for acid rain, and nitrous oxides, the main constituent of smog. Carbon monoxide is another airborne pollutant. It is a colorless, odorless, non-irritating, but very poisonous gas that replaces the oxygen in your blood if inhaled at low concentrations. Volatile organic compounds, known as VOCs, include the potent greenhouse gas methane, as well as other chemicals like benzene and toluene, which are linked to leukemia. Ammonia is emitted from agricultural processes, and much of it comes down with rain to land in the oceans, where it can cause toxic algae blooms. All of these chemicals are released into the atmosphere in gas form, but there is another whole class of airborne pollutants known as fine particulate matter. It consists of tiny particles of liquid or solid suspended in the air. When the tiny particles and the air that they're suspended in are taken together, it is called an aerosol, a term you're probably familiar with from numerous household products like deodorant and hairspray. Human activities have drastically increased the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere, and they are linked with numerous health problems, including heart disease, lung disease, and even cancer. So, if you've ever heard the term emissions and wondered what that meant, well, now you know.
Thanks, Marcus. For those of you just joining us, this is Terra Informa, the environmental news heard across Canada.
I don't think people realize how big the sacrifice zone is going to be.
Do we want those jobs and keep dying?
If you're not careful, over time, you will see larger and larger pulses of arsenic in other cancer makers.
There's my uncle Raymond. He had died with a brain tumor.
From health and environmental concerns to the front lines of a mounting international protest, Canada's oil sands battle the fallout.
What you just heard was the trailer for the new oil sands documentary that's airing this week on David Suzuki's The Nature of Things. Putting it together was a 2-year process for the filmmaker, Tom Radford, which saw him talk to scientists, government, industry, and concerned community members. Today he talks to us about the effect the experience had on him and the messages he took away from it. Here's director Tom Radford in conversation with Samantha Power.
There have been a lot of documentaries on the tar sands specifically. What made you want to do this one and get involved in this project?
One of the reasons we were really excited that this was a science show was that a lot of the films that have been made are kind of very accusatory films. A tremendous amount of them are political opinion. They're not based on, as the scientists would say, data. You know, so you can say, oh boy, we think there might be cancer downstream, or we think there might be poisons in the water, but you don't have any data to back up the argument. And so we thought the fact that for this year, a little more than a year, that this internationally respected team of scientists was going to be studying the river, studying the watershed, that made it a chance to make a really different film.
That's actually something I really noticed about your documentary, is the communication of the scientific aspects. I mean, I follow the tar sands quite closely in my own job, and I didn't realize that Schindler's study focused on the snow around the area, around the Athabasca River.
Well, that would, and that's that. I guess in a funny way, that's the smoking gun for the science, because, you know, the Alberta government had always said, well, we do our own science.
Mm-hmm.
We know there's stuff in the water, but it's just coming from the banks, you know. And then the whole business of studying it in the winter when it can't be coming from the banks was, I think, a real breakthrough in how they did the science.
Do you see a problem with the two competing arguments that are developing out of the sciences, I guess? You know, one study isn't scientific enough and someone different is funding it, and this one's been peer-reviewed, and there seems to be an argument about what is science and what isn't science developing.
Yeah, I think the greatest statement, my favorite piece in the movie, is that David Schindler debate where he is debating with the Alberta scientists, the Alberta government scientists, at the University of Alberta, and he says that in all the things he's worked on in his life, there's always this kind of misleading science out there. Science which you can't say, you know, that's wrong, that scientist, but but the data isn't there. It isn't published. And you, what you end up doing is just having, extending this debate over years and years and years, and people get tired of it and they give up on it.
Mm-hmm.
And as Schindler says in that debate, he says this is what the tobacco industry did. A lot of the climate change people do it. I mean, just to the point where the public says, you know, who am I supposed to believe here? And they actually get to the point where they think there's two competing sciences.
Mm-hmm.
But in this particular case, only one body of science has data. And that, you know, I thought that scene at the end of the movie where the federal panel, you know, and we're talking about the federal government here, which is incredibly sympathetic to the oil sands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for them to say, hey, stop it, guys. We need world-class monitoring. We need science that is transparent, the data is published, that we know what's going on and the public knows what's going on. That you know, that's tremendously encouraging, I think, that is what that federal panel has called for. You know, up until now, I mean, as David Schindler says towards the end of the movie, when the federal panel reports, and he says, we've had 13 years where we thought the government told us monitoring was going on. And now we have these panels come forward and saying the monitoring was completely inadequate. Need to set up a world-class system. And that's sort of a tragedy that we've lost 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the positive side of that is that, okay, if we get it right now, we'll get it right. And the development in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, will be done better. You know?
And do you think that will happen?
oh boy, I'm not. When John Baird, who was minister for a little while
mm-hmm.
after Prentice, and Elizabeth Dowdstoyle, who you know, head of the UN Environment Agency. These are the top people in the country. When they say we have to do this properly, I think you have to be optimistic. It was a bit of a surprise 3 weeks later when Peter Kent became environment minister. He just seemed to go off on a completely different tack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but a commitment is a commitment.
There are a few people in your documentary, the art director for Avatar, who I was struck by something he said, that one of the excuses of the tar sands is that it's necessary to the way the world operates. And then he goes on to say, we don't have to operate this way. And you do explore some of the alternative energies that might be, you know, being researched. Do you see a turning point in it? In that way at all, that we as a society, you know, might need to change some of the ways that we operate?
Yeah, I mean, that's why we went to California. I mean, it seems to me that you know, California as a state is more powerful than Canada as a country. I mean, you know, California population, the strength of its economy is like dealing with a major country. It's like dealing with England or something. The very fact that Schwarzenegger has done what he's done, with the low carbon fuel standard, with all of the biofuel research, wind and solar that's going on there, I mean, we really wanted to show that there is another path. I think what the film sort of asks at the end is, will we take that path in time?
That was Samantha Power interviewing director Tom Radford about his film Tipping Point, The Age of the Oil Sands. It's airing this week on David Suzuki's The Nature of Things. For showtimes, stop by our website at www.terrainforma.ca. Well, that's all the environmental programming we have for you this week. Stay tuned in next week when we bring you another 30 minutes of the news in nature.
FRU is looking for new shows.